This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and this week we'll explore another dimension of the culture of consciousness. The inspiration this week, for me personally, comes out of a trip that I took in 2001 with my wife. We were going to go to the Holy Land, but then the two towers disappeared, and we thought it would be better to stay outside of that part of the world. And we heard about a tour to Zen temples in China, and we were both pretty into Zen at that point, and had never been on a group tour before, but figured that that would be a pretty decent way to see China, which can be pretty daunting to the solo traveler. And, of course, you know, we think about Zen as being a Japanese tradition because that's pretty much how we heard about it here in the West. But, of course, its origins lie in China, and there's actually tons of sites in China that reflect Zen's history there. So we went on this wonderful tour, and on the tour was a fellow who was co-leading it named Bill Porter, who I also found out at the time was also known as Red Pine, a wonderful translator of Chinese poetry, of Dharma texts, and under the name Bill Porter, also a great travel writer about China. And we hit it off and had a wonderful time, and I learned a great deal from him, particularly about tea. He's a fabuloso tea fanatic, and we had a lot of fun going into tea shops in China and getting down with the folks and tasting tons of delicious oolong. And I'm very happy to have Bill on tonight or today, depending on where you are. And but first, I'd like to bring on our co-host, Maja, the esoteric librarian of Los Angeles. And I know, Maja, that you have a particular, well, one might almost say fetish for Taoist immortals and such. So you probably have some questions already getting lined up for Mr. Porter here.
Oh, man, do I ever. I love those crazy Chinese.
Did you ever practice Taoist stuff?
I have. I even went to school for Chinese medicine, and I got super into Taoist immortals and, like, the crazy stories of the old, you know, of old lore of the, you know, ancient Taoists who would live for hundreds of years. And, of course, I was really into kung fu and martial arts for a very long time, so I'm, like, a super geek on all this stuff. And actually, the first time I had heard the name Red Pine was of the original Taoist immortal Red Pine. That is from actually an ancient immortal named Red Pine who appears in a lot of the Taoist poetry, who was an immortal that could do all these crazy things like, you know, fly and touch mountaintops and, you know, just you name it. And so then I found out that there was this book by Red Pine when I was in a bookstore, but then I found out that it wasn't, you know, the immortal Red Pine. It was actually Bill Porter. And then I started reading his books, and it was just totally amazing and delightful. So I've been a big fan of his stuff for a long time.
Well, great. Now that we buttered him up, we can bring him on. Bill, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Eric and Maja. Nice to be spending the morning with you.
Very good. Did you already have some tea?
Yeah, I had some tea, a couple pieces of toast, and I'm good for the day now.
Excellent. Well, since we started off talking a little bit about Chinese Taoist immortals, I would love to hear it. Also, I actually don't really know this story about what led to your first book under your name, Bill Porter, Road to Heaven, which is a book about searching out these Chinese hermits. Because when I think of a Taoist Chinese hermit or a Buddhist hermit, I think of, you know, the Middle Ages or something a long time ago, and I think of modern China and
how much transformations it went through in the 20th century. And I would even be surprised that there were such characters, but you track down some of these people. Tell us all about how that came about.
Let's see. So I guess it was 1989. It was like the spring of 1989. And, well, you know, the reason I was interested in this is because I translated the works, the poetic works of two of China's most famous hermit monks, that is Hanshan, or Cold Mountain, and another man not so well known, in fact not known at all in the West, a man named Stonehouse, or Sherwu, Qinghong Sherwu, who lived in the 13th and 14th centuries. And so I translated the works of these men who lived in caves and huts, respectively, and wondered if the tradition still existed. It was just that simple. And I was am still married to a Taiwanese citizen who's a government worker in Taiwan at the time, working for the phone company. So because the Taiwan government prohibited its citizens from going to China until 1987, had I gone, being married to a government employee, I would have caused her some pain had I gone at that time. And so in 87, the Taiwanese government lifted its ban on its citizens going to China, which then opened up the possibility that then I could go to China as well. So in 1988, the fall of 88, I applied to the Guggenheim Foundation for a grant, you know, to go over and look for hermits and then, you know, to write about it. And I was working for an English language radio station in Taiwan at the time. So it was the U.S. Army station that the U.S. abandoned when they recognized China. They had to move out of the country and left this station. And the Taiwanese government realized that its main source of support was from America, and it really wanted to do everything it could to cater to American business people in China. So instead of taking over the radio station, they set it up as a nonprofit. And half the members of the board were American Chamber of Commerce people, and the other half were Chinese business people of note. And so they ran the station, and because it was uncensored, both the news and the music, and we had this huge audience. It was the biggest radio station in Taiwan, millions of listeners at any particular moment of the day. We always had 2 or 3 million people listening. So a huge listenership. And so I worked for this radio station. I was in charge of local news, Taiwan news about Taiwan, and I did interviews too. Of course, I was restricted to interviewing people who spoke English, but any prominent figure in Taiwan spoke English. And so one of my interviews in the March of 89 was with the son of the richest man in Taiwan. Man was Winston Wong, head of Formosa Plastics, Nanya Plastics, biggest plastics maker in the world. And so toward the end of our interview, I asked him, said, "So what would you tell a graduate today?" And he caught my little joke immediately, you know, having been educated in the West. He had two PhDs from England. He knew I was referring to the movie The Graduate, and about that little line, like, you know, plastics, son, plastics. And so, but instead of saying plastics, son, plastics, he said, I would tell them to follow the Tao. And I was so impressed with that. After the interview was over, we chatted on a little bit, and I said, this is probably my last interview, because in the next week or so, I should be getting the award letter from the Guggenheim Foundation. And we had such a good time chatting. He said, "Hey, look, if they don't give you the money, I will." And of course they didn't. I'm just always an optimist. I applied to the Guggenheim on eight occasions. That was my first occasion. And I called him up a week later, and he said, "So do you want that in cash or traveler's checks?" And because I'd said I'd probably need around $3,500 for just an initial foray, and he said, "Look, if it works out, I'll fund the whole operation." So I called up a friend in America, who's a photographer, a friend of mine, and said, "Hey, we got money for a trip to China. You want to take pictures?" And so this is a man named Steve Johnson. Lives here in Port Townsend, one of my neighbors. Still has his dark room in my basement. So we showed up in Hong Kong and went off to China together. And it was May Day of 1989, and to look for hermits.
Did you have any sense that you might find? Did you think it might be like a fool's?
Oh, of course
errand?
It was. In fact, my last interview was the interview after Winston Wong was with the man who was in charge of all of Taiwan's affairs with mainland China. And the man's name was Ma Ying-jeou. Ma Ying-jeou is currently the president of Taiwan. I figured he must know something about conditions in China since that's his job. So I told him what I was planning to do, and he said, "You're crazy." He says, "There's not even any real Buddhist or Taoist in China, much less hermits." And so he said it was a stupid idea. But anyway, I had a free ticket, so we went up to Beijing, and I thought that would be a good place to begin, not looking for hermits, but just trying to get some connections. And I just happened to walk into this one monastery that was the headquarters of the Buddhist Association in China. It was located in the monastery, and one of the young monks saw me wandering around and said, "Oh, you must meet the master." And so he introduced me to the abbot of the temple, a man named Jing Hui. And I started talking to him about my project. And he says, "Oh, I think I've heard of hermits still in China, in the Zhongnan Mountains, south of Xi'an." Anyway, so I went down to I didn't know where the Zhongnan Mountains were at all. I'd never heard of them, but went down the Zhongnan Mountains, got a taxi driver to drive me to the foot of, this is a mountain range that's 800 kilometers from east to west and 150 kilometers north to south. So it's just a huge range of mountains. So I didn't know where to go. So he just took a taxi to the foot of where a road ended, and I told the taxi driver to come back, pick me up in 2 days. And Steve and I hiked up this trail that herb collectors used, and about an hour later, we were writing down hermit addresses. We found a mother load of hermits in China.
Amazing.
In fact, in this one county alone, there were at least 500 hermits.
It barely counts as hermit anymore.
Well, there's lots of mountains. We don't really think about it because we say, "Well, China, there's a couple billion people," but there's lots of mountains in China. And nobody really wants anything to do with the mountains. Right now, they're just now developing the idea, the system of national parks, nature reserves, and so forth. So some of these areas are being cordoned off. But there's anybody who wanted to until recently, who wanted just to go into the mountains and build a hut, was pretty much free to do so. In fact, there's still a lot of freedom in this regard in China. Because they see it as a spiritual part of a spiritual quest. So the hermit tradition, anyway, I found out was alive and well in China and had not really been affected by the Cultural Revolution.
Well, how, for the people doing it, if you think about it, a rough equivalent in India, say the sadhus who sort of live, as hermits or as wanderers, and some of them are like deeply devoted. And some of them are just like dudes who figured out that was like the best way to get through life. That was the way they wanted to go. They weren't necessarily motivated by deep religious convictions. In terms of all the characters that you met, how did you find how deep was the spiritual currents that these people were still continuing?
Well, I never have met a hermit in China who I would characterize the second way you did as somebody just looking for a way of feeding themselves every day, because there were a lot better ways of doing that in China than being a hermit. Perhaps in India there weren't, but China was not as impoverished as India. And the people who go into the mountains to become hermits willingly, voluntarily endure a lot of hardship. And they wouldn't have to do that if they didn't want to.
Funny, too, because everyone seems to go to India looking for gurus and the mountain men and those kind of like mountain hermits, but everyone's like, could care less about hermits in China. Like, people don't even make that association with the spiritual man. of the mountain hermit in China. They just go to India and think they're all over there.
Yeah, well, I think the two traditions have some distinct differences. When I did go to China, even the Chinese were amazed that the tradition still existed. In fact, when my book was translated into Chinese, it became very popular. In the last 3 years since it came out in English, it sold 100,000 copies.
Wow.
And the government or the Buddhists in the Xi'an area even formed a hermit association, so they could take them mail and food and have doctors visit them periodically. So it's funny that the Chinese are now well aware of the hermit tradition. In fact, this month's National Geographic in China features story and the cover story is my second book, Zen Baggage, about the relationship between hermits and Zen monasteries. The distinction that exists in China that perhaps doesn't exist in India is that the hermit tradition is really what we would consider spiritual graduate school. Whereas in India, my understanding is if you go off to be a hermit, that's your career. Mm. But it's a life practice perhaps. But in China, it's never seen that way. It's always something you do for a period of your life if that's what you want to do. And just like our graduate school doesn't attract all undergraduates, the hermit tradition doesn't attract everybody who becomes a monk or a nun or who practices Qigong with a master, but I would say perhaps no more than 10% of the people who are called by one of China's spiritual traditions, be it Taoist or Buddhist, only about 10% at the most decide to go to graduate school. And every monastery or nunnery in China has a relationship with a specific mountain that has been established over hundreds of years where they send their graduate students. And there's huts up on certain mountains because of that. And other mountains in China, there's not a single hut because no monastery has developed that rapport with that mountain. And so you go to China, you go into the mountains, you'll meet people on certain mountains living in huts. But they won't stay there. The idea isn't for them to stay there for their entire lives. The average I found was about 3 to 5 years. And so that's why I sort of compare it to our graduate school.
Do you find that when you were visiting, did you find it a romantic calling for you? Like, did you go, oh man, that looks just so great to be able to just drop out and be a hermit in the woods? And did your experience of what their experience was like make you, you know, appreciate it more or make you more aware of the hardships involved?
A friend of mine just came to my front door and I had to have a little chat with him just for a minute. But could you repeat that question?
Sure. I was just wondering whether part of what drew you to the Chinese hermits was a kind of, a romanticism or a sense of what a special magical kind of life that would be. And I'm just curious how your experience of what their lives were like, how that changed your feeling about what they were doing.
Oh, well, I don't know. We all have different personalities, and I've always been an outsider personality. That is, you know, not one who joins groups or feels at home in a group. So I've always been sort of a loner or an outsider. So I suppose I was attracted to these sort of people. But when I went to Taiwan, I lived in a monastery for a little over 3 years, and I just accidentally, you know, karmically, the abbot happened to publish a collection of Cold Mountains poetry, and he pirated Burton Watson's translations of a third of the poems. So I ended up with this little book that he gave me that he had published. So it was my first acquaintance with with the poetry of a hermit, and my first acquaintance with Cold Mountain. I didn't realize how well known he was through Jack Kerouac and Gary Snyder until a little bit later. So I just sort of ran into this hermit, you know, at the monastery, and ran into his poetry. And at the time I was living in the monastery, I had decided to try my hand at translation as a way to improve my Chinese. It is, I would look at a Buddhist text for which I had an English translation, and then I would see how I would work through that text using my dictionaries and so forth. And so I started doing that with some of this poetry too. So it's just, that's sort of what drew me to Cold Mountain's poetry, is this sort of just karmic accident, interest in translation, and perhaps a little bit the fact that I could identify with him, you know, his lifestyle.
And I know Burton Watson was one of the fellows who translated some of the Red Pine poems. I'm just curious, was that where you first kind of came across Red Pine, and why did you kind of adapt that name for yourself?
Well, I didn't even know that there... I'm not aware that there are any Red Pine poems. I've never heard of any Red Pine poems. I certainly don't write any. And Red Pine was the rain master of the Yellow Emperor. He lived around 2600 BC. Certainly there are no documents. We don't have any. We have a few things ascribed to the Yellow Emperor that were written probably around 500 BC. But when I was living in the monastery, so just to talk about the name a little bit, I was living in the monastery, you know, just like when you live in another country, sometimes you have a name that fits in with that culture. It's like when Asians come to America, they're called John or Mary. My name in the monastery was a Chinese name that the abbot gave me. It was Victorious Cloud, Sheng Li, Sheng Yun, rather. Sheng Yun. So Victorious Cloud is a name that works in a monastery. But after 3 years in the monastery, the abbot, you know, I was just sort of freeloading. The abbot asked me if it wasn't time I thought about becoming a monk. So I told him I don't think I'd be a very good monk because, you know, I always kept a bottle of whiskey in my room. Well, actually, I was very much into cream sherry at that time because I had a Chinese girlfriend, or at least there was this Chinese girl I used to meet once a week at this coffee house. And we would look at Chinese poetry together. She would help me with the language, and I always took this bottle of cream sherry with me because that was something she liked to taste, too. So anyway, I didn't think I'd be a good monk. So I moved out a little bit after that. And moved to this mountain where I lived, ended up living in this farming village for 14 years outside of Taipei on a mountain. The village is now part of a national park. It's about an hour outside of Taipei on a mountain called Yangmingshan, beyond Yangmingshan. And there's a little village called Bamboo Lake, the Juzuhu, and I rented this converted farm shed. And, you know, I was in a new society. I wasn't living in a monastery anymore, so I needed a new name. I needed a name for my ex-monastic life. So I was just looking for a name. One day I was riding the bus that went down the mountain every couple of hours, and the bus stopped at this big billboard for Black Pine Cola, and I said, that's the name, just the color. You know, red is the Chinese color. So I started using the name Red Pine without any knowledge of whether it was a decent enough name. It just, you know, clicked. And then it was about 6 months later when I was translating or studying the poetry of Qu Yuan, who lived around 300 B.C. I loved Qu Yuan's poetry. He was the first great Chinese poet. His death, of course, is responsible for what the Chinese celebrate as the Dragon Boat Festival, where every year they try to race boats to get to his body, because he drowned himself, to get to his body before the dragons and the fishes could eat it. So I was reading some Qu Yuan poetry, and I came across some commentary about Master Red Pine. Then I realized that Red Pine was a legitimate name. It had some sort of, you might say, a Taoist connection. And I just said, well, then I guess I can use it. So I started using it. Of course, red pine, master red pine's name includes a t at the end of it. It's Chersungzi, just like Confucius is Kungzi, Laozi is Laozi. When you put that t at the end of a name, that means master.
Master.
Like Master Confucius, Master Lao for Laozi, Master Red Pine, Chersungzi. So my name's a little bit different. It lacked the master part. It was just the ordinary red pine. Anyway, I used it, got away with it. Nobody seemed to mind that I called myself Chersung. And when it came time, a couple years later, I published, self-published my first little book, a book called The Ox Herding Pictures. And then at the same year, I was also publishing my first complete translation of Cold Mountains poetry. It came time to choose a name, and I began to realize how I work as a poet, as a translator, is more like a shaman works. That is to say, I'm very much dependent on lots of of influences and forces that I can't even give a name to. So I decided to use the
can
name.
Can you talk
Red
a little
Pine.
Bit more about that, Bill? Just like what about, because, you know, if you're not doing translating, you're not that familiar with the process of it. Could you just talk a little bit about your process in terms of allowing those other forces into your day-to-day grind?
Well, I think every translator works differently, and I'd be surprised if any translator works like me. I mean, we're all drawn to a language for different reasons, and we have different appreciations for it, and then when we work that language into our own language, we have different agendas. Whether it's a scholar or a poet or a religious person, I don't know how other translators work, but my way of translating is, the most important thing to me is to be open. I use a dictionary all the time. I mean, I've been studying Chinese, using Chinese for 40 years. It was 40 years ago this month. It was 40 years ago this month. I was filling in an application. I was getting a degree in anthropology at Santa Barbara. Decided I wanted to go to Columbia University to study with Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict. And so I was filling out the application, and they had all these boxes you could check for financial aid, and there was this language fellowship. And so, well, I didn't know any languages, but you didn't have to know them. You just had to want to specialize in that. And I had just read a book by Alan Watts called The Way of Zen that I thought made just wonderful sense. And so I just checked that box and wrote in Chinese. And son of a gun, they gave me this four-year fellowship to study Chinese and then anthropology in the anthropology department there. So that was my introduction to Chinese, just by pure accident. I had no interest in Chinese. I was interested in anthropology, and I needed some financial aid. But as I started studying at Columbia, I became less and less enthused about anthropology and more interested in Buddhism, especially Buddhist practice. It is meditation. I met a monk and would often spend the weekends in the countryside at his little retreat he had. And so I started meditating. And so when I went, eventually after 2 years at Columbia, I realized that getting a PhD in anthropology was a farce. It was not what enthused me at all. I didn't want to do it, so I just quit their program and went to this monastery in Taiwan. And so that is how I got interested, how I got connected with the Chinese language. But when I started translating, as I said earlier, I started it as a way just to improve my Chinese, to force myself to see if whether I really understood something. Because you can think you can read a Chinese text or text in another language, but you don't necessarily really understand it unless you try to translate it. That sort of really puts you puts the question to you about what words, how would you say this in English. And so I started doing that with sutras and with poetry. So it was a certain kind of literature. I wasn't doing novels or academic texts or anything like that. So it was the kind of literature that itself is very open. Any spiritual text or any poem, you know, is like a jewel. You look at it in a different light; it looks very different from time to time. And so, my approach to translation reflected that ambiguity, the fact that there's no one right way of ever translating anything, that it's always intuitive. It's always depends on how you're feeling that day, whether you're drinking bourbon or tea. And so I translate with that in mind, and I guess I've translated now for almost 30 years, and about 7 or 8 years ago, there was this college in Boston called Smith College. It's a women's college, and they decided to hold this big conference on Chinese poetry, and they invited me, asked me if I would present a short paper on the art of translation. And I'd never thought about it. I'd never had no idea what I did. I just translated, and then I had to sit down. And so I wrote this little three-page paper that's floating around the web called Dancing with the Dead. And that was when I realized that what I do as a translator is I'm attracted to a dancer. I see the movement of words on a page. And to me, there's this beautiful movement going on. And what I want to do is I want to dance with that dancer. But in order to do that, I have to get past just the movement of that dancer, but I have to hear the music that they're dancing to. And so I tell people, for me, translation is like dancing. It's like most people think translation is dancing with your feet on top of somebody else's feet. That's called the literal, the accurate, and for many people, the good translation. And of course, there's always the sort of impressionistic translation where you're dancing across the room from somebody. But for me, translation is getting as close as I can to my partner, but not becoming that partner. I'm not trying to write in Chinese. I'm trying to write in English. So I'm dancing English dance, but with the rhythms that I feel, the energy that I feel in my dance partner, whether it's the Buddha.
You do it more like through sympathy or harmonics, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I like to think of myself as sort of a shaman, but I'm not a shaman. I mean, but I think in order to get this sense of the movement, I can't think at all. It's not a thought process. It's an intuitive feeling, gut approach that I use to translation. And that's why I use the name Red Pine, to honor all my muses, all the forces that make it possible for me to dance that dance.
There's a very good line from the Secret of the Golden Flower that says, when all movement stops, the movement of heaven can begin. And that reminds me of what you just said, how you have to, like, stop thinking, stop moving, and allow it to come in. And that's when, like, the true movement kind of starts.
Well, it is. Yeah, for me, it is very similar to that. It is. It's, and it's definitely not intellectual. But you, naturally, when you're working on a translation, you have to go through a phase where you become extremely familiar with the language and solve linguistic and problems of syntax, grammar, and so forth. You've got to get past that. But if you really admire, if you really feel the power in this language you're trying to translate, then you've got to convey that in your language. That's sort of my idea of translation. That's why I can't just translate anything. I get people sometimes ask me to translate for money, and I told them I can't do it, even though I could use some money. But it has to be some poetry or a sutra or something that really I feel the energy of. Anyway, that's sort of, I guess, a very long digression about why I use this name, Red Pine, and it sort of goes back to that my connection with Chinese poetry, sutras, but it's also sort of a goof because I just like to screw around, and I think names are absurd, and I think Bill Porter is just I mean, I could be called RTD2. What's the difference? There's really no difference. It's just you're trying to identify an object. And Bill Porter has, I'm not a Bill. I'm not a Porter. I don't carry bags around. I usually, well, backpack maybe when I'm hiking. But
Zen baggage.
Zen baggage, yeah. But I thought Red Pine is sort of a funny little name, and what the hell? You know, it's, I mean, in other cultures, names have a certain relevance and are given with more relevance than nowadays. We just want a pretty name, a nice-sounding name, and has no meaning at all. Of course, in Chinese culture, many people had a series of names. That is, you'd have your birth name, and then you'd have your name that the people outside your family knew you by, and then you would have, if you became an artist or a poet, you'd have several names. And so I like the idea of names that mean something. And, I mean, nobody calls me Red Pine, you know, and I certainly hope nobody makes out a check with that.
We'll keep that in mind as we're setting that. But we need to take a break right here on Expanding Mind. I'm Eric Davis. We're talking with Bill Porter, and we'll be right back after these promotional messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Thoughtful, provocative, cutting edge. The Ask Dr. Eisenstein Show. Other doctors will scare you of the disease. Dr. Eisenstein will scare you of their treatment. Dr. Eisenstein is a practicing physician for almost 40 years and graduate of several prestigious medical schools. Since 1973, he has been the medical director of Home First Health Services in Chicago. The majority of the 23,000 families in this practice deliver their babies at home, breastfeed their children, choose not to vaccinate, and use natural treatments whenever possible.
Hi, I am Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. If you want to hear the other side of the story, tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for an hour of questions, answers, and lively discussion. Call me with your medical questions. I would love to talk with you.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, I'm Daryl Clark.
Bob Levis.
Ron Waits.
And we're your Progressive News Weekly team here on Progressive Radio Network.
Shank of the Morning, the Shank of the Week, Wednesdays, 10 a.m., 11 a.m.
We are you as if you had a mic in your hand the way we do.
It's news you can use. News for you, by you, and of you.
Grassroots activism.
So will she look, folks.
Krishnamurti's dialogue is between him and us.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti's talks are about the art of living, which is greater than all things that human beings have created by mind or hand.
Krishna.
It's greater than all the scriptures and their gods.
Krishna.
It is only through the art of living that a new culture can come into being.
Krishna.
All existence is relationship. Without it, you cannot live.
Krishna.
There is only the actual and nothing else.
Krishna.
What is taking place now is free of time.
Krishna.
This is the evolution of our conditioning.
Krishna.
The art of living can come into being only when thought does not contaminate love.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti talks. Thursday nights at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Become enlightened.
Krishna.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. We're here with Eric Davis, me, Maja, and Bill Porter, Red Pine, but really he has no name. We were talking a little bit about some of these Chinese hermits, and I am very fascinated with a lot of these immortal Taoist stories, and I was wondering, as you went through these mountain trails, and you said these were herbal trails that were like for, I assume, for collecting herbs, and I was wondering how much you came across in these Chinese hermits that they were actually practicing some of these kind of alchemical immortal techniques, whether that was through diet or use of herbs. I know in a lot of the Taoist alchemical material, they have stories of these elixirs that they would make, you know, a lot of them involving cinnabar and things like that. Did you get to experience any of these folks that were kind of practicing immortals, or not so much?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, you run it. I mean, when people go into the mountains, they don't necessarily. I mean, there's certain people who have Qigong and herbal practices or dietary practices are part of the tradition they're studying with their master, but many aren't. Most aren't, I would say. But when they get to the mountains, they're as I said earlier. You know, you come to a mountain, you want to live as a hermit. It's a certain mountain where there's going to be other hermits, and there's always a hermit network. And the old hermits are always teaching the new hermits how to do things. One of those things, of course, is herbal knowledge, with what plants you can eat, what you can't eat, when to pick them, how they appear, which plants you can collect and then sell to herb collectors. And of course, Qigong practices themselves. A lot of Buddhists never practice Qigong, but if they go to the mountains, they're certainly going to have to learn how to do that, just maintain their health, if nothing else. So older hermits are always transmitting that knowledge. So there's a sort of a lot of communication of practices, but you might say everybody practices a little bit of everything in the mountains, but there are definitely people who are more devoted to this than others. I have a German friend, young guy. I think he's maybe just turned 30, maybe he's 29. He's the only Westerner ever been allowed to live at Shaolin Temple. He's been a monk at Shaolin for 12 years. He's been living at Shaolin for 12 years, and he often travels. He's especially interested in the tantric arts, and he lives with specific masters in the mountains at different times of his career. He's every year or two he'll go off to a certain mountain to study with a specific master to learn a specific technique. In fact, he's writing a book about this right now.
Like tantric qigong techniques?
Yeah, tantric qigong techniques are his specialty. I mean, you know, living at Shaolin, you have to do martial arts as well.
Right.
You don't have to. You're encouraged, and he does that too. But his interest is in tantric arts, and so my interest is not in tantric arts. It's been in Zen, and so when I go into the mountains, I chat with everybody. And there are these people that you're talking about. And my friend Shan Li is his name. Shan Li loves to go in the mountains, and he ignores the Zen people and goes against the tantric herbalist, Taoist guy. So people have different interests when they go into the mountains. And so...
there's a lot of crazy stuff. I mean, I was wondering also, like, some of the specific dietary practices where, like, someone will just eat, like, one thing, you know, like how some of them would just eat, like, pine needles. Say there's all these stories about how some of them would only eat pine needles for their whole lives, and then they would kind of do this self-immolation where they would just kind of burn themselves up. Did you come across anything, like, super fantastical like that at all, or...
No, I didn't. But then again, those are the kind of people you wouldn't meet.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's not like they cultivate secrecy and solitude more than others. Most hermits are quite happy to see visitors. I mean, you would too if you're living in the mountains, you know. But the Taoists attend not so much. The Buddhists are always happy to see someone. The Taoists, their meditations are often more complex, and
And I've just noticed as a general rule of thumb that the Taoists are introverts and the Buddhists are extroverts. And so the Taoists really want to be left alone. They want to get into that herbal, that dietary and that Qigong practice that involves longer periods of meditation than the Buddhists. The Buddhists are often just chanting the name of the Buddha, and they're quite happy to put the Buddha's name down for a cup of tea. Whereas the Taoists are not. I've had some Taoists, you know, close their door or not open their door. But there are people that you imagine in China doing what they're doing, what they're known for doing. Of course, things can always be described in fantastical ways. So I can't tell you anything about any of the truth or falsehood of any particular account.
Billy, you've been going to China for what, you know, over 20 years now, and you know, over here we hear so much. You get such an impression of an incredible, you know, dynamic, transformative, crazy process happening in China. How does that process? How do you see that from your perspective in terms of being interested in these streams of practice, these religious and spiritual streams? How is China's modern transformation changing the things that you're interested in China?
Well, you know, it's a culture that is, well, when 1979, when they finally, you know, held the third plenary and reannounced such things as freedom of religious practice, the Chinese people have become more interested in these areas. But the primary interest in the 80s and 90s was in earning, and suddenly they were allowed to have money and to work in a way that would generate money so they could buy things that they couldn't even dream of having before. And so they've been doing that. And as everybody in the world knows, they've been extremely successful at it. But and of course they've, you know, got educations, and unlike Americans, who Americans are more like the real Chinese in the world. China means the Middle Kingdom, and Americans think of themselves as the Middle Kingdom, and we don't really have to know anything else about the world because we're the center of the universe. But the Chinese are not like that. They want to know everything about us, everything they can. And so they've been really acquisitive, not just in terms of wealth, but also in knowledge. And now they're reaching a satiation point where they've got it, and it's not good enough. So when I go to China, when I go to monasteries, there's so many young monks and nuns now, people with college educations turning to spiritual paths. They've made their money, and they've realized it's not the satisfaction that they were hoping to get. So I guess you could say that the Chinese are they're not quite doing what we were doing in the 60s. Maybe it's more like the 50s. I don't know. But they're becoming more and more interested in something more, and of course their own traditions. The people who are in their 30s and 40s have no awareness of Chinese traditions, of spiritual traditions. Because of course it was forbidden for the period when they were young, and but it's not forbidden anymore, and so there's lots of people out there practicing and looking for teachers and buying books and going to monasteries and taking part in retreats. Naturally, it's a big country, and so I couldn't even put a figure on it in terms of percentage, but I just know that a lot of well-educated younger Chinese people are becoming more and more interested in spiritual life. That's about all.
That's
I
can. I'm curious. What project are you working on now?
I'm working on the Lankavatara Sutra. It's a Buddhist text that was the primary text used by Bodhidharma when he taught. Bodhidharma being the Indian monk who brought Zen to China around the year 500 A.D.
And some say Kung Fu also.
Yeah, some people say that too, exactly. So he is a very prominent figure, and Dalangka was the text he recommended the most, and all of his early disciples, the first couple generations of Zen teachers, used Dalangka. But it's an extremely difficult text, and later they often preferred the diamond, something like a shorter text, a easier to read text than the Lanka. Anyway, it's something that was translated into English about 80 years ago by D.T. Suzuki. Not a very readable translation. I was just talking with Michael McClure last week, and he was telling me back in the 50s, he and Ginsberg and Snyder were all excited about the Lanka. And then they bought copies and tried to understand the sucker. And, of course, it was just impossible in using D.T. Suzuki's translation in English. So I thought it was about time that, since I've become a translator, that I translated it.
One of the wonderful things about your sutra translations that I think people not familiar with the Chinese approach to these texts is that you include lots of commentary that is both your own in terms of explaining certain things, but also drawing from this enormous collection of literature that's grown up around these texts. Well, I think in the West, you know, even a serious, you know, not scholar, but a serious Buddhist practitioner who's trying to read will approach it a sutra raw. They'll just read that sutra, or the Vimalakirti Sutra. They'll just sit down and read it, whereas in your translations, you present a section of text and then all of this commentary, and it's a real different approach to it that really changes the experience. Where does that approach come from?
Well, that is the Asian, and specifically, it's the Chinese approach. I'm not introducing anything new, except that I'm introducing something to the West that hasn't existed, but the Chinese view commentary as one of the great literary art forms. And a Chinese person would not read an ancient poem or an ancient text of any kind without a commentary. They might read it in order to memorize it, to chant it. But if they were reading it to understand it, they would always have at least one commentary, and maybe a collection of commentaries or an anthology of commentaries. They would certainly read the Tao Te Ching or the I Ching, or any of the great poets. Nobody would read the poets without a commentary.
I just wanted to mention, for folks that haven't seen your version of the Tao Te Ching, that's why it's my absolute favorite, because you have all these different commentaries by these amazing, you know, Chinese figures through history, and to have that there with the Tao Te Ching, all the commentary, is what is completely extraordinary. It's totally amazing.
Well, and I just scratched the surface with that, but the main point I probably should make, this idea of commentary, is that these works of literature or of the spirit are viewed as so profound that you can talk about them or think about them very slowly. I mean, they're best digested slowly. There was once a famous Zen master on Mount Wutaishan who lectured on the Lotus Sutra every day for 3 years and never got past the title. And so that's the point I like to make, is that these poems or these ancient texts, the words are just an excuse for you to explore yourself, and that's the way the Chinese use them. And so you'll read two different commentaries, and they'll have a very different approach to that text, because what they're really doing is using that text to explore ideas that they've been trying to bring out of themselves. The Chinese love to write like this because the Chinese like a certain amount of humility. And so this allows them to be humble and yet to be bold. That is to say, they're writing a commentary, so they're hiding their words under somebody else's words, but yet they're writing whatever they want to write, from their understanding. So commentary is a great literary tradition in the in Asia. You see it sometimes in the West. I mean, certainly there's commentaries for the Greek classics, the Iliad or the Odyssey, or maybe the Paradiso or Milton's works and things like that. Gibbon's History of the Roman Empire has got a great commentary, but you don't see it much because Westerners are not very humble. That is to say, they don't like to play second fiddle to the main text. They like to supersede the text with one of their own.
There's another aspect of that, which is that Buddhism in America, to talk particularly about it, is so associated with the idea of experience that if you're a Buddhist practitioner, even if you start reading, it's like everyone's going to let you know right off the bat that like you can't really get there in books. You have to do it outside of books. And so while that makes sense to some degree, because obviously you can get too caught up into words or intellectual concepts and not practice, but I think sometimes it goes too far and that it doesn't recognize the spirituality that is in reading, that is in language, that is in letting language work through you and change you from the inside. And that's clearly from what you've been talking about, both in terms of the commentary and even just the way that you translate, is that for you the Dharma unfolds in many ways through your encounter with language, through words, through writing, through reading, and yet it's not a secondary process. It's at the core of the unfolding.
Well, and plus these spiritual traditions that are coming to the West are the teachers are often Asian, almost always Asian, the first generation, and don't communicate well in terms of a verbal communication. And the main thing that they've introduced to the West is the importance of the basic experiential practice, that it all has to be fired in the kiln of your own spirit. And so meditation is important, but what Westerners often don't realize is those teachers who came to teach them spend years reading texts, and they always have in China or Japan read hundreds of texts, lots of texts. But we always see as the tip of the iceberg, and so we think, oh well, that's all we have to do is just be the tip of the iceberg. And so Western spiritual practice, as far as representing the Buddhist or Taoist traditions, is often lacks the underpinning that a good education in the tradition as expressed by the masters of the last 2,000 years would have given them a much deeper a sense for the varieties of practice. Because when you work in a religious community, the teacher you may find yourself with may not be the teacher for you. But yet, if you have a bunch of books you can read, you may find better instruction in those books. So
great. Well, that's a perfect place where we're going to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us, Bill. And folks, check out Bill Porter's books and also the translations under Red Pine, and you can avail yourself of some of those kinds of teachings. So I'm Eric Davis. It's Maja. See you next week. Thanks, Bill.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Eric. Thanks, Maja. Look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah.